Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 213, but we're going to talk all about tires. I've had a bunch of questions about tires lately, and you know what? It's time to have a whole main section just about tires, and this is it. We're also going to talk about propane tanks and some new things that might be a little bit dangerous. A product review about a couple of fairly inexpensive fans that might be perfect for your rig, and a place to visit that involves unartificial light. Some fun stuff there. Welcome back, folks. Thank you very much for tuning in once again. I'm very happy to be here with you. I have gotten a couple of folks asking me about tires lately, and it's interesting because they're asking about different things. So I thought we should talk about tires, because after all, the tires are the only part of your rig that is actually touching the planet, hopefully. The rest of it is up in the air, being suspended by these little patches of rubber, and they're extremely important. And there is a lot to know about tires. Tires are not the kind of thing that you can just ignore. You have to have some working knowledge of them, and it's a bit more complicated than you might think. So I've made a list of 10 different topics to talk about with tires, because it's so big of a topic that it's difficult for me to actually keep it in my head to talk to you about it. But know this going into it. Nearly every choice you make about tires is a compromise. There is no perfect tire. There are tires that are good at some things, but everything a tire is good at means it's bad at something else, and you have to figure out what you really want, what are your major priorities, and then get a tire that matches them. In fact, the compromises are so great that in northern climates, like in Massachusetts where I grew up, we had two sets of tires for our cars. We would put snow tires on in the winter because the summer tires we had were terrible in the snow. But winter tires cost gas mileage, make a lot of noise, have a harsher ride, and you kind of see where we're going with this. So let's actually just talk about that. Number one I have down here is, which tires have the best ride? Now, we interpret best ride to be kind of soft, meaning you'll go over bumps and not feel them so much. And then handling is another part of that too, although, believe it or not, those two things kind of contradict each other. So generally, the tires that have the best ride are going to be a little bit wider. They're going to be maybe underinflated a little bit, and they're going to be made out of a softish rubber. That's right, tires are made out of different kinds of rubber depending on their application. A heavy-duty truck tire might be made out of a stiffer formula for rubber, and also it may have more plies. It's not just one piece of rubber in there. There's layers of rubber, and then there's cord that keeps the rubber together, and then sometimes there are steel belts. Remember, if you're my age, you remember there was a big advertising campaign about steel-belted radials, and the idea was that the steel made the tire stronger. Well, I don't know if that's still true or not, and I've heard of Kevlar being put in tires. There's all kinds of things now, but yeah, there's a lot of variety in tires, and ride is just one of the things that you can improve by doing some things. But, and this is number two, the tires that give you the best ride will not be the tires that give you the best mileage. The tires that give you the best mileage are going to be stiff and thin and actually give you a harsh ride. If you want to improve your gas mileage or diesel mileage in your vehicle, you want to inflate your tires as much as is safe, because the harder tire provides less rolling resistance than a softer, less inflated tire. And that saves fuel mileage. You're going to get beat up every time you go over a pothole, and your kidneys aren't going to thank you any, but you will be getting the best gas mileage. But you will be giving up, and this is number three, traction. Traction and ride are fairly related. The tires that give you the best traction are also softer and underinflated in most cases. But they'll also have an aggressive tread. They'll have really, you know what I'm talking about here. You've seen these tires, AT tires. I have Nokian Outposts that are fairly aggressive. They look like they're going to bite you if you get near them. Yeah, those kind of tires absolutely give the best traction. They don't necessarily give the best ride because they're so chunky. They make a lot of noise and then they can wander around the road a bit. But all those chunky parts will dig into the dirt. And the latest thing now is to put some of those chunky parts on the outside of the tires. Like my Nokian Outposts, the sides of the tires aren't smooth. They're very rough. And the idea is you get stuck in mud, those rough parts will dig in the mud. But generally, and this is number four, all those chunky parts are going to make the tires loud. So if you want quieter tires, then you want tires with fewer knobby bits or maybe smaller knobby bits. Some of the quietest tires out there are the high-end Pirelli tires, and they have little tiny knobby bits that do provide good traction on dry pavement. Not so much in the mud. They're not going to give you anything in the mud, but they're very, very quiet. However, all those little knobby bits can actually make tires wear faster because there's more contact with the road. Therefore, if you want the longest lasting tire, you need to look at a different aspect of tires, and that is mostly how the rubber is made. And you can just look and see the reviews on how many miles the warranty is for the tire to get a tire that will last the longest. But those long-lasting tires will not be the ones with the best ride or the best mileage or the best traction. They're optimizing for the longest lasting. Now, speaking of pressure, and this is number six, what tire pressure should you keep your tires at? I mean, if you look at the sidewall of your tire, there's a tire pressure listed there, but there's also a tire pressure listed in your owner's manual, and there's also one usually on the side of the inside of your door. When you open your door and the door jamb there has a sticker on it, that sticker almost always has tire pressures on it. Often they're different for the front and the back. So with all these different tire pressures, which one do you use? Well, in general, the tire pressures that are written on the door, that sticker on the door, those are the optimal tire pressures. Those are the ones that give you a pretty good ride, pretty good mileage, pretty good traction. It kind of optimizes all these different compromises into what is the best. The pressure that is on the sidewall of the tire is the maximum pressure that you never want to exceed. And you never, ever, ever want to fill your tire to that pressure. If you have a tire that says 45 PSI on the tire and you fill it up that way and it's cold, after you drive down the road, it's going to exceed that 45 PSI, and you don't want that. So don't worry about what's written on the tire. It's actually what's written in the owner's manual and on the door jamb that matters the most. But what would you do if you wanted to optimize something other than everything? Well, you can increase your tire pressure a little bit, as I mentioned before, to increase gas mileage. But what is more common is decreasing the pressure a little bit. So if the sticker on your door says 45 pounds, maybe put in 40. That'll give you a smoother ride with better traction. But if you're going to go off-road, then we're entering a whole new world. A lot of people will seriously take down the pressure in their tires to maybe 20 PSI or 30 PSI, and that will give you a better ride, but more important, a lot more traction in off-road circumstances. Now, you're not going to be going very fast off-road. When you lower the pressure like this, your tires can't handle going very fast, so keep that in mind. And also keep in mind, you need a good air compressor to air them back up once you get back to pavement, so don't do this unless you have a way to get air back in the tires. Now, there's an important thing to talk about with lowering pressure in tires, and that is if you lower it too much, the bead can come off the tire and your tire can go instantly flat, and that can be a pretty difficult repair if you're out in the boonies. So don't lower it too much. I think 20 is pretty safe if you're being cautious. I would only go lower than that in an emergency situation, like if I were really stuck. I would see maybe lowering it down to 10 and then being gentle with it as I tried to get out, but then I would pump it back up higher than that as soon as I could. So be aware of that. And yeah, get yourself a good air compressor and a tire repair kit. They're fairly inexpensive and good insurance to have. Now, some people think it's better to put bigger wheels on their vehicles. Now, this was very popular with the NV200. A lot of people thought the NV200s had too small wheels, and they were a weird size wheel, too, to add insult to injury. And you can do this, and it will give you better traction, and because there's more rubber hitting the road, and it can raise your vehicle up. It's like a little bit of a lift, and some people like that. And what a lot of people like is the look of the bigger tires. Like, ooh, wow, I've got like this big, massive Hot Wheels car or something. I am not one of the looks people, but I know there are many of them. Some folks will just get a really big rim and then a really thin tire. These are called low-profile tires. And they're really not great for anything we're doing. Those kind of tires are meant for highways only. They're not very good off-road. And when I saw that Land Rover was coming out with standard low-profile tires, I really had to question what they were doing. Well, no, I didn't. They were not interested in off-road anymore. They were just interested in being cool-looking. So anyway, rant over there. You should know if you put bigger wheels on, you can have all kinds of problems. The wheels can rub against your fenders. It's going to mess up your speedometer, because if you think about it, your wheels will take longer to do a rotation, so your speedometer is going to read too low of a rating, which is bad, because you think you're doing the speed limit, but you're actually going faster, as your GPS or a cop's radar will tell you. And you're going to lose some gas mileage. Smaller tires are better at gas mileage because there's less rolling resistance with a smaller tire. So I would think twice about getting larger tires. I know some people love that. And I know if you're going to do a lot of off-roading, like if your vehicle's going to live in the dirt, yeah, okay, there are some advantages there and you might want to consider it. But know that there are drawbacks, just like with any of these things. Number eight I have is the snow summer tire thing. If you live in a place like Vermont or Maine or Montana or someplace where it snows all the time, most of Canada, yeah, it's not a bad idea to have two sets of tires. Have the tire optimized for the season, because that changes things quite a bit. I had a Land Rover when I lived in Vermont, and in the summer I had the low profile tires that came with it. Very expensive tires with the stupid big rims, whatever, it came with it, and it was fine. I did not do that much off-roading in Vermont. But then in the winter, I actually had replacement wheels, and I put in Nokian Hakkapeliitta tires. These are Finnish tires that are just amazing, and they were studded, and that thing was a beast in the winter. It was impossible to get stuck. That's not true. I may have been a little overconfident, but those tires really, really performed well. But if I had kept them on in the summer, the studs would have made a lot of noise, they would have messed up the road, and I would have had a lot more traction, but my gas mileage would have suffered. Anyway, folks in the South may not have ever heard of this changing tires thing, but yeah, in the North it's fairly common, and it's not a bad idea. Now, tires have a bunch of ratings on them. You know, there's a speed rating and a load rating, and there are charts for these things. It's not hard to look up a tire speed rating chart, but some of them are a problem, and actually van life people have to be careful of this. For example, if you have an L-rated tire, L-rated tires are for off-road and light-duty trucks, so like an NV200 or a Toyota Tacoma or something like that, you might find an L-rated tire for those. And they're fine, except that they have a maximum speed of 75 miles an hour. I mean, that's below the speed limit in some places in the United States. So that's something to be aware of. That might not be a good choice. Then there are the R-rated tires, which I think are probably better. That's a heavy-duty light truck tire. It's good for 106 miles an hour. So that one is probably more reasonable for our vans and trucks. But you have to be careful. When I got my NV200, the front tires on that vehicle were for cars. They were car tires. They didn't have the load rating necessary for a vehicle like that. So even though they fit perfectly on the rims and the thing drove okay, they could not handle the weight that the NV200 could handle. And I never had a problem. I replaced them fairly quickly. But know that you also have to look at the load rating as well as the speed rating. And what you want basically is an LT or a C type tire if you're in any kind of a van or a light truck. If you have a minivan, you can kind of mess with it a little bit. But those standard passenger car tires that might not have a rating, they might just be blank there, generally not as good for vans. Just be aware of that. Another thing to be aware of is tires expire. Yeah, we hear about tires, you know, oh, I get 50,000 miles out of these tires, whatever. That's one factor. The other one is time. If you have, say, a schoolie and you're not putting that many miles on the vehicle every year, it's not the miles that are going to make those tires need to be replaced. It's time. And the maximum you should ever keep a tire on a vehicle, any kind of vehicle, is 10 years. And it's often much less, as low as 5. Now, there's a way to tell how old your tires are without keeping good records or anything. Every tire manufactured has a little kind of a highlighted area with a 4-digit number. And that 4-digit number is a very simple code. The first 2 digits are the week it was made. So the first week of January is 01. The last week of December is 52. You get it. In the middle somewhere, obviously, it's going to be like 26. You know, June will be 26. That's the easy part, but it's not the most important part. The next two are the year. So let's say your tire was manufactured in January of 2022. The code would be 0122 or 0322, depending on which week in January it was made. And so looking at that, you know that, okay, in 2027, these tires will be 5 years old, and I have to replace them by 2032. Very important to know, because tires will fail if they're old. You'll start to see cracks in the sidewall, and yes, sun exposure can exacerbate that. So even though the tire has perfectly good tread, it still might not be safe. So that's an awful lot of talk about tires. I'm going to stop right there, but take your tires seriously. Spend some time learning about them. It could save your life. Thank you very much to Robbie and an anonymous person for buying me some diesel this week. I certainly appreciate it. If you would like to help support this podcast and keep the ads away, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you can buy me a gallon or two of diesel, and I'll keep producing the podcast without any ads. And we all like that. Tech Talk. Propane tanks, pretty simple thing. I used to be a propane filler tech. I had a little certificate, and I would be the guy at the RV shop that if you needed propane, I'd go out and do it. And, well, they don't do it the same anymore. I just had a couple of propane tanks filled by a professional at Love's. And I learned a few things. One is that these guys don't know what they're doing. At least this guy didn't. And it made me realize there's a couple of things you need to be aware of with modern propane tanks that are different than back when I used to fill them myself. The first is that the person filling the tank may not know what they're doing. I was using the big tanks, the 30-pound tanks, which were on the front of the Airstream. These are the kind that you can't just swap because they're so big, you have to have them filled. And so I hauled them up the hill down in Tiki Bago Land to the Loves, which is on top of the hill, and had them filled up. And everything was fine, and the bill came, and there's 17 gallons of propane for $71, which I thought was an awful lot, but okay. And I hauled them back and installed them and everything. And then a day later, I heard this kind of like a bang noise. And then I heard, and I could smell propane. And I was like, wow, that's not right. So I looked, and my tanks were venting. And your tanks have a safety valve in them. If the pressure inside gets too high, they will just let propane out. This is why you can't leave propane just sitting in your van. It has to be in a locker, because this can happen even at low temperatures. It was only 80 degrees out. It's not like these things were sitting in the sun. They're in an enclosed box on the tongue of the Airstream, and they were venting. So I was like, well, what the heck's going on here? These tanks aren't that old. Yeah, tanks expire like tires too, but that's about 12 years, and these are nowhere near that old. So what's going on? Well, they were way overfilled. So 17.1 gallons. Well, the problem is that each one of the tanks I had only holds 7 gallons. 7 times 2 is 14. I had an extra 3.1 gallons of propane stuffed into these tanks. And that's a lot. This stuff doesn't compress that much. Those tanks were as full as they could possibly be. And I noticed that when he was filling them, he didn't undo the release valve. There's a screw that you can undo, and liquid will come out when the tank is full. And he didn't undo that. And I thought maybe he had a machine that would automatically tell. No, it turns out he just filled them up way, 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 way too much. So understand that if you have your tanks and you're going to have somebody fill them, make sure they don't overfill them like this guy did. And it costs me more money, and the tanks are now dangerous, and all that extra propane is just getting vented into the atmosphere, which is not good. The other thing I wanted to tell you about propane tanks is there's a fairly new safety feature in them that if you open your tank and there's something on, like a hot water heater or one of your burners is on or anything that uses gas, the tank will detect that and turn off. When you open the tank, you'll turn the valve and you'll hear a tink. And that is this rod sliding into place, preventing gas from coming out. And this is a safety feature so that you can't just open the tank and let all the gas out. It simply won't allow you to do that. So what you have to do is close the tank all the way, make sure it's completely closed, and then make sure everything in your system is closed. No hot water heater, make sure that's turned off, make sure your oven's off, and your heater and your stove and all that's off, and then slowly open your tank, and that will let the gas flow. This has caused a lot of confusion and frustrated a lot of people who just couldn't figure out why they had no gas. So anyway, two tips for you there regarding propane. Make sure you get the right amount. And yeah, if you swap them, you're not going to have to worry about it. Just know that swapping tanks is generally more expensive. And open that thing slowly and make sure all your propane's turned off. It's the way to go. Product review. So there are many, many, many nice fans that you can get for your rig. And, you know, obviously we talk about Max Air fans all the time, then there's Fantastic fans. But there's also a few that attach to the wall that are really nice. I mean, there's this fancy one on a gimbal that sailboats use and the really fancy rigs use. And I've got a few that don't have a cage. They're just a blade that spins around, and they're pretty good. But they're all kind of expensive. And as I've been renovating the Scamp, I'm trying not to spend a lot of money. So I have a problem in the Scamp in that there's no ventilation, there's no Max Air fan, and there's no place really to put it. I've got one giant vent in the middle, and then I've got solar panels covering the rest of the roof. So where do I put a fan? And the answer is I kind of don't. I'm not going to put in a Max Air fan. But what I did put in were a couple of those chrome fans, the type you might see on the dashboard of an old big rig. They're just very simple chrome fans. And I found a deal, sort of a deal, at Amazon where you can get two of them for $50. That's not bad. And these are high flow fans. I'm very happy with them now that I have them installed. They have two speeds each. There's a switch on them. You flip the switch and they make a really nice humming noise. They move a lot of air and they are going to totally be enough for that Scamp. Now, there's a couple of things I want to warn you about with these though. They come with a cigarette lighter plug. I didn't use that. I just cut the plug off and wired them into the lighting circuit like I said I was going to, and that worked fine. So, yeah, you can use these with the cigarette lighter outlet if you want, but you have to screw them into something. The base must be screwed into something. There's no clamp. There's no way for it to sit. It won't stand up on its own. Now, you could just screw it into a big block of wood, and then it would stand up on its own, but at that point, I think you should just buy another fan. But that said, once I screwed it in with the three screws, and it has a nice gasket, it just works. It doesn't rattle, it just blows a lot of air. Now, the quality of these things, I wouldn't say is too great. One of them didn't work out of the box, I had to take it apart and fix it, and it's missing a screw. It's gone. The screw's not in the box. It wasn't in the bag. It just came from the factory without a screw. But once I fixed it, it was fine. So I don't think these are the greatest quality. But for $50, you can get a lot of 12-volt airflow from these two. And I think they're probably worth a look. The brand name is Tujo? Tujoe? T-U-J-O-E. I don't know how you pronounce that. But that's the brand name. They're 8-inch fans. And they just work. You can actually take them apart and clean the blades. You can adjust the blades. Everything is aluminum or chrome steel. There's no plastic at all. They have a very classic look. And honestly, I'm actually pretty happy with them. So for $50, I think this isn't a bad way to go. And they're very simple. There's no remote. There's nothing to go wrong. It's just a big old fan. So I'll have a link in the show notes. Or if you want to search Amazon yourself, Search for 2 pieces 12-volt 8-inch car RV cooling fan with 2-speed switch heavy-duty metal fans with cigarette lighter for cars, trucks, van, RV, boat, and buses. Silver. Yeah, go ahead and check the link in the show notes. Tales from the Road. I may have told this one before. Again, I'm an old guy. I reserve my right to tell stories more than once, and I may be doing that now, but I may not be. I don't know. But back in the day, this would have been the late 80s, I was working for RPS, which is like UPS, except it's RPS. It's a trucking company called Roadway that tried to get into the package business. I don't think it worked very well, but my job was to load the trucks at night. So this is an overnight job. I was sitting in a warehouse. I was running around in a warehouse loading trucks. And this was a time in my life when I was trying to make as much money as possible. I was about to move to Utah and possibly get married, which I did. So when there were chances to make a little overtime, I would take them. And sometimes I would stay late through the morning. And they had jobs to do. Like one of the jobs was to find stuff that fell out of its boxes and put it in other boxes and ship it off somewhere. And I don't know what happened to it. I did that a lot. That was pretty easy work. But then one day this guy said, hey, you looking for some work? And I was like, sure. And he said, well, come ride with me. So he was one of the drivers, and he needed a helper because he was working in downtown Boston. And Boston's a very tricky place for a truck. I learned how to drive a truck in Boston. It's very difficult. There's nothing grid-like at all unless you're in South Boston. It's just a spaghetti of roads with all kinds of different rules and no place to park. And, you know, you have to deliver 100 packages to this one massive building, but there isn't any parking for several miles around it. The only thing you can do is park illegally. And that's actually what the drivers do. They just park illegally and they know they're going to get the ticket and they just pay it. It's kind of crazy. But this guy had a very heavy day, and he was by himself, and he just wanted some help. And I was a strapping young lad, so I figured, what the heck, and I'll go make some money. Now, this guy was, he was, like most of these drivers, very work-focused, very efficient. If you've ever spent any time with a UPS driver, they're very efficiency-focused, and this guy wasn't that much different. But he was a little odd, and he liked to cut corners and stuff, and all right, that's fine. This is his route. He would tell me, here, give me a handful of packages, take them over there, and I would, and that would be my day. It was on the ride home that things got strange. We are driving home from Boston. Now, our depot was in Woburn. That's W-O-B-U-R-N, Woburn, Massachusetts. And we were heading from Boston to Woburn. And we got to a part where the traffic had eased up. There was only one seat in this truck, the driver's seat. I was standing in the back, kind of behind a bulkhead. Totally not legal, but this was life in the day. And the guy says, hey, do you know how to drive this thing? Now, as it happened, I had a commercial truck driver's license. So, yeah, driving a step van wouldn't have been any trouble at all. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, I could drive this thing. And he said, okay, here you go. Now, we're doing 60 miles an hour up 495, and he just gets up and comes into the back of the van with me. So while I'm staring there wide-eyed and jaw-dropped, we are both in the back of the van as it's going down the highway at 60 miles an hour. Now, it was slowing down because he wasn't stepping on the gas anymore, and being that it was a manual shift, it was slowing down a lot. But there was nobody driving. And so, fortunately, my reflex was like, holy cow, I better grab the wheel. So I ran up front and sat in the seat and grabbed the wheel and took control of the situation. And before I could turn around and say, what the hell was that? He's climbed up onto the parcel racks and he's gone to sleep. Like instantly, like in 3 seconds, this guy has gone to sleep on the metal rack. And so I'm driving this truck just completely awake now. I mean, forget, this is a double shift. I had been working since 10 p.m. the night before, and it was 5 p.m. the following day. I was no longer tired. He was, of course, and he didn't even have to stay up all night. So I drove back to the depot, parked the truck, he paid me, and that was the very last time I ever worked with him. Because that was the single most dumbass thing I have ever seen anyone do in a vehicle that I was in. a place to visit. It might be too late for this. It might not be. I don't know, but you should know about this. In the Smoky Mountains in Tennessee, they have fireflies. Now, they actually have 19 different species of fireflies there. There's many more than that across the United States. And this time of year is when the fireflies start coming out and doing their thing, which, of course, is to blink at us. And we like it because it's bioluminescence and it's very cool. And yes, I know that other places call them lightning bugs and things like that, but fireflies is what I'm going to call them because I'm a fan of the TV show. So there. Anyway, the Smoky Mountains has a special claim to being the world capital of fireflies, not because of their 19 species, but because of one species they have that is called a synchronous firefly. Fireflies blink different frequencies. They do all kinds of different things with their blinking. Some of them blink to attract mates. Others blink a fake blink to make the other firefly think it's a mate, and then they eat them. There are these weird fake cannibal fireflies out there. Some of them blink once, some blink three times, some blink as they fly and do these loops in the air, but the ones in the Smoky Mountains blink all at the same time, like Christmas lights. During parts of the year in late May and early June, you can go to the Smoky Mountains, and the trees will all blink like they have Christmas lights on them, all at the same time, on, off, on, off. And it's fireflies doing it. It's a very cool natural phenomenon. If that sounds like something you want to do, cool, I encourage you to do it. That's the good news. The bad news is, this is so popular that you actually have to apply for a lottery to get in there and see it. And there's a separate lottery for parking. There are so many people that want to get into the Smoky Mountains and see this that it's actually a big issue. So what do you do? Well, first you go to the link in the show notes, and that will take you to the lottery, and you can go through that whole process. Or you find someplace else in Tennessee to watch this, because obviously these fireflies just don't hang out in the Smoky Mountains. Tennessee is where these things are. So it's a very cool thing. I have seen this, not in the grand scale of the Smoky Mountains, but I have seen it occasionally in places I've been. It's all about what species of firefly is where you are. And it is a very cool thing. So I do have a link in the show notes for this specific one. It's one of the world's, or at least the country's, great things to see. And that is the synchronous fireflies of the Great Smoky Mountains. You might be too late to see it this year, but you could get in on the lottery for next year. Resource recommendation. I just had to do something to my truck. My truck is an 8-foot-long bed. It's a 2019 Ram 1500 Classic. It's an old-fashioned Dodge, big, dumb Dodge pickup truck. I mean, it's a Dodge. It's not even a Dodge anymore. It's a Ram. Big Ram pickup truck, kind of an old-fashioned two-door. Nothing fancy, but I bought a cap for it. Really old cap. It's probably 15 years old, and I don't even know what vehicle it came off of. It might have been another Dodge, but it was a much older one. And it doesn't fit the bed exactly right. It's long enough. It's 8 feet long. That was the important part. But I couldn't close the door right, and the bed on my Ram is tapered. So what did I do? Well, I used this resource to fix it, and it is PVC wood. So what I needed to do was raise the canopy up a little bit so that it would fit better, and that's exactly what I did, and now it fits perfectly. And all I needed to do was put these 1x3 strips of PVC wood underneath. Now, why did I use PVC wood? Well, PVC wood has two advantages over regular wood. The first is pretty obvious. It's not wood, so it doesn't rot. It's a white strip of basically plastic. You can drill screws into it. You can cut it with a regular saw. You can do a lot of the same things you can do with wood, but it won't rot. And since the thing is basically going to be outside all the time, I thought that was a good thing. Plus, it's bright white. I don't have to paint it. It actually matches my truck, which is also bright white. The other thing it does that is better than wood is that it flexes. It's very, very flexible. And you can even flex it in the hard-to-flex direction. So if you imagine a big, long 1x3 piece of lumber, it'll bend in one direction. The other, it's going to be very stiff. But if it's PVC, it will actually bend in that stiff direction. And that's exactly what I needed to deal with the tapered edges of the bed of my truck. There are many places in your van where PVC wood would be preferable to regular wood. Now, regular wood is stronger, regular wood is more predictable, it doesn't melt, it holds screws stronger. There's a lot of reasons to use regular wood. But if you're in a situation where you need some extra flexibility, or you need a place where the stuff absolutely won't rot, like you're putting it at the bottom or something like that, well, heck, I think PVC wood is just great. I find it very polite to work with. And as a bonus, it has no splinters, which I think is wonderful. So I don't have a link for this. You'll find it at any big box store, Home Depot, Lowe's, whatever. They have PVC wood and PVC molding, and there are definitely times where it is preferable to wood. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 213. I very much appreciate you sticking here with me. It is what keeps me going. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg, and I've got a whole bunch of travel coming up. I'm going to be in Colorado and New England and all kinds of places, so who knows what's going to happen this month as far as the podcast goes, but I will do my best to get an episode out every week. Until then, remember the words of John Steinbeck, who said, "In early June, the world of leaf and blade and flowers explodes, and every sunset is different."